she says. I don't like how Babel set up the fights outside the escape pods, but at the end of the day, did they force you to fight? Or did people choose to fight? I think we signed on for this. If we do the job, we'll be rewarded. I see no overwhelming evidence to disbelieve Babel's ultimate promises. Not yet. Alex takes up Morning's cause. The girl on your ship, Emmett. What was her name? Kaya, I reply softly. Her name was Kaya. What about her family? Alex asks. Will they be paid? Parvin shrugs, and I've never seen a more heartless gesture. It has my pulse soaring. She didn't fulfill the contract, Parvin says. I imagine Babel will send the promised salary, but we agreed to this. We took on the risk. We signed the papers. I don't trust myself to speak. Azima notices my trembling and sets a hand on my shoulder to steady me. I let the words I want to say burn holes through my tongue. I'm trying to file this one away, but it has me too hot to think straight. I'm thankful when the others speak up for me, because I'm not the only one bothered by Parvin's response. Anton says, "We didn't agree to die. We didn't agree to kill. Would your parents trade the money to get you back, Parvin? To see you safely home? Don't be heartless." "Heartless?" Parvin replies. "I'm being logical. Did you even read the contract?" "Of course I did," Anton snaps. "I don't remember anything about forced murder." "No," Parvin replies crisply. "But there's an entire page about the risks of the venture. We decided to come anyway. We took a risk, a calculated one. Holly knew that when she signed up. Kaya knew it too. We took that risk because we wanted the money." "Enough," Morning says. She holds out a small device, no bigger than her thumb. She makes a show of pressing play. "I know how much you like evidence, Parvin." Audio trembles out. We all know the voice. Babel's chief of space operations, David Raquin, speaks with that familiar confidence.
"We chose our Adams and Eves carefully."
A muddled voice replies. Raquin answers with bite.
"That's not the point. We have to keep up appearances at home until it doesn't matter. That's the point. Make the payments, supply the treatments, and put on a good show, Roman. Do that for the next year and it won't matter."
The other voice sounds again. The words mutter and rattle.
"They aren't going home," Raquin answers. "If any of our top-tier plans succeed, they'll never be interviewed or interrogated by anyone on Earth. Going home was never a realistic option, and you know that. They would shed too much light on our operations in space. Either the Adams and Eves can start a new world here, or they..."
His words gutter out. The truth silences everything. I've known about Babel's dark side since the day Defoe shoved Karpinski down in front of me and offered to let me execute him. But I still feel like I'm falling through worlds. This is confirmation. They aren't taking us home, and they never were. I can see the truth hitting the entire room. It's not just Parvin either. A few of the others have spent all this time thinking the best of Babel. Morning shoves the device back in her pocket. "Is that enough reason to react?" she asks. I know I should be thinking this through, analyzing it all, but my first thought jumps to the fact that Morning had this tape and never shared it with me. With Anton, but not me? Parvin looks defeated. "I didn't know." "No one knew," Morning replies, her voice calm and assuring. "But now that you do know, I hope you understand why we have to act. Babel intends to keep us here. For what purpose, I don't know. But they aren't gonna let us go home. As long as they control the Tower Space Station, we're stuck here. We know they're shipping Nixia back to Earth, so we know there are freighters returning that way. Problem is, Babel controls everything in space right now." I can feel the knowledge of last night burning like a hole in my chest. I glance over at Jamie. He locks eyes with me, clearly struggling with the same thing. But this is our family. Down here, these are the only people we can actually trust. "We found one of Babel's backup plans last night," I say. Attention swings my way. I was helping Jamie with his wound. He nods in confirmation. I noticed scuffs on the floor. There was a trap door that led down to a secret chamber. They have about 70 Marines stored in cryogenic chambers, just waiting to be activated.
Anton whistles. The rest of the crew looks like they almost don't believe us. Azima's dark eyebrows are about through the roof.
Frozen Marines? I want to see them, she says.
They're not an exhibit at the zoo, Katsu snarks.
Morning waves them to silence.
So they're just sleeping?
I nod. For now.
Kit found us down there, but he didn't suspect anything. He thinks we're all babble, just like him. His dad is down there. He's one of the frozen soldiers.
His dad?
It's the first time I've seen Nora speak and not smile.
This is so wrong.
Look, we have to keep in mind that Babel's never had a foothold on planet. I've been thinking about the logistics ever since we found the bodies. The Atomites have been winning this game since jump. Every one of you saw that first video. Babel got butchered, man. So what changed?
We did.
We are their only way onto the planet. There are nods all around. Morning changes directions.
So what about the Atomites? Can we trust them?
Trust the Atomites? Parvin asks, like all of this is ridiculous. I get that they've held their own against Babel, but there's no sign of them succeeding in space. Do they have a fleet of ships I've forgotten about? Fighting Babel means destroying our only way home. The idea of not going home silences everyone again. I don't have any real answers. No one does. Both Parvin and Morning are right. Babel has us chained up pretty good. The Imago seem like our only possible ally, but there's something off there, too.
Imago, I say out loud.
Let's have enough respect to call them by their real name, not the one Babel made up for them. They're called the Imago. Morning nods gratefully at the correction.
And I'm not sure how to feel about them either.
The others are listening closely.
I forgot that at least a few of them respect me and see me as a leader in my own right.
I mean, you noticed how happy they were, right? When they met us for the first time? It makes sense. Babel said they don't have kids. But all this talk about restoring hope and all that, it just doesn't line up, you know?
We know who Babel is. But I say the jury's still out on the Imago. I don't think we can just throw this at them and expect they'll play ball.
I'm surprised when Longway adds his voice to the conversation.
Didn't the rest of you read through the databases?
He asks.
Babel gave us the information they gathered. Primary resources from every employee that ever spied on the Imago. It wasn't hard to determine they were dying out.
No kidding, Katsu fires back. We all understand what no longer can reproduce means, Longway. We're old enough to understand sex ed,
but did you ask why they can't reproduce?
Longway replies softly.
There have been at least 4 recorded interactions of humans and the Imago. Babel also had satellite reports of hunting parties and maintenance crews that left Seven Set to visit other parts of their world. In every single report, the Babel employees notes there are no women present.
Can you imagine? They haven't seen a woman outside of Seven Set in 2 decades.
The only mention of women from the Imago so far are the daughters in the Sanctum. All the facts point toward extinction, do they not? How can a society go on without women?
Morning nods.
Parvin found some of those reports too. So what's your point? What does all that have to do with us?
Longway considers the others.
I am always hesitant to team with desperate people. If the Imago are on the verge of dying out, I would be cautious of partnering with them.
Everyone nods at that. The others look even more worried. Thankfully, Anton steps forward and answers.
We can only depend on ourselves. That's why I'm going up.
Going up? Azima echoes. Back to space?
He nods.
I launched inside the first Nixian shipment. I came up with the idea when Kit showed us the silo. Morning and I talked through the manipulations I'd need to make it work. We're pretty sure I can survive the ascent without much of a problem. Kit's going to launch the first shipment when we hit the right quarters. If it works, we'll at least have someone in space. It's actually a genius plan. Baba will have charted out every detail on the surface, but I doubt they imagine a member of our crew could head back up into space. I can already imagine Anton up there, putting a torch to all their plans. Excitement snakes through the group. Every face, except for Alex's. He looks helpless, furious.
What will you do up there?
Azima asks curiously.
I'll keep quiet, he says. I'll learn what I can and put myself in a good position. I've been working on stealth manipulations for days. It won't be easy, but if I can get some help, we can change the game against Babel. We already have one person up there that's willing to help. The same person that got Morning that audio.
Which brings us to the next part, Morning adds. Can anyone else help us? I know you might not have reached out to the techies or workers, but what about your medics? Anyone that we can trust? We could use more hands on this. We all exchange glances. A spike of sadness guts me. I barely even thought about Vandemir since landing. The last time he saw me, I was about to face Rothi. Does he know what happened? Did Babel tell him I survived? I hope he knows. I hope he's safe. Mine can be trusted, I say. Vandy will want to know what happened to me. If Anton tells him what's going on, I know he'll help.
That makes one, Morning says. Anyone else?
Longway shakes his head. Jamie and Azima discuss it quietly, but agree their medic would be too nervous to play the role of a spy. Quick and quiet conversations chase around the room, but the only other duo with a trustworthy caretaker is Omar and Holly.
Andy will help, he says. Just make sure you don't put too much pressure on her. She gets a little anxious when she's pushed outside her comfort zone.
Very reassuring, Anton mutters. That's more help than we had when we started, Morning says. All right, I don't want anyone going near the silo. In fact, I'd like for there to be a ton of movement right around the time that Kit sends up the first Nixian shipment. Give Babel a lot to track and a lot to watch. Anything to keep them from noticing Anton's boarding. Everybody fathom?
The whole group nods.
What about the Imago? I ask. What do we tell them?
Nothing for now, Morning says. Not until we get to Seven Set. But I want you to plant some rumors. The story will be that Anton got pissed off about something and left to seek an audience with the Atomites. Sorry, the Imago. It's kind of perfect that Isadora did the same thing. It will make that story more plausible. We'll keep some of his gear with us so that Babel doesn't try to track him. It'll be hard, but the longer they think he's down here, the better chance he'll have to make a difference in the space station.
What if they catch you? Parvin asks. Anton transforms a piece of Nixie into one of his trademark knives.
I'll keep these nice and sharp.
This is great, Katsu says. Just like when the Russians landed on the moon.
Everyone looks at him. Jamie laughs for what feels like the first time since we landed.
They didn't land on the moon, Katsu, he says.
Katsu looks skeptical.
I read about it. It happened in the 1960s.
That was America, Anton says.
But the cosmonauts got to space first.
Exactly!
Katsu nods enthusiastically.
Send in the cosmonaut!
All right, Morning cuts in.
Does everyone agree that Babel's the enemy?
There's another awkward, stretching silence. Parvin looks less stubborn, and eventually she nods. Murmured agreement echoes. If we're going to face them, it has to be together. And does everyone agree we'll explore our options with the Imago? Moore nods.
Good, she says. We're agreed. Shoulder to shoulder.
This time, the whole group echoes the phrase. There's an edge in Morning's voice that's contagious. We're all tired of being pushed around, and it finally feels like we're ready to push back. Back in Detroit, there were basic lessons that every kid learned growing up. Where to go, what to say, when to vanish. One of those rules was that a person fights hardest when they're cornered.
Babel has us right where they want us, but they don't see the rush of adrenaline, the fists balled up and ready for a fight. We all take a second to wish Anton luck. The Russian politely asks us to quit blowing smoke up his ass. Morning laughs and brings down the barrier. I watch the group drift apart, and it's not hard to see the difference. Purpose. We walk around like we have a good reason for every single step. Chapter 14. A New Song. Emmett Atwater. Night comes, and it's hard not to notice that Kit's on edge, frustrated. Babel came down hard on him. He moves around the base and tries to reclaim his authority, saying we'll have to start our digs early the next morning. I can't help wondering if Babel relayed the fact that we had a secret meeting while he took care of the trucks, but I have no idea what kind of surveillance they have here. We don't give him much reason to be suspicious. Jazzy leads the group through a game called Signs. I've never played it before, but it's actually kind of fun. The group sits in a circle, passing an invisible ball with specific hand signals, while the person in the middle spins around trying to catch the right person at the right time. Morning signal is someone pulling an arrow from a quiver and firing. I use a waffling shake of the hand. Surprisingly, Morning is really terrible at the game. I can't help laughing when she finds herself in the middle of the group, struggling to get out of the circle. Kit tries to remind us to get some sleep, that we'll need our energy for the early morning. But for me, there's a lightness stretching over Foundry that has everything to do with Isadora's absence. Nora was staring daggers at me 2 days ago, but now she doesn't even seem to care about Isadora's vendetta against me. I'm thinking about Isadora and Seven Set, trying to convince the Imago of my guilt, when Jazzy takes the seat next to me.
I did what I could to explain, she says. Isadora, I know how she's feeling. It's awful, but I know you, Emmett. If I had to trust anyone in this base to tell the truth, it'd be you. I told them that. Ida wouldn't listen. She's obsessing over the idea of getting back to Locke. But Nora and the others are coming around. We know that whatever happened wasn't your fault.
Her kindness humbles me. Thanks, Jazzy. She smiles.
What are friends for?
Across the room, Katsu has unearthed a dusty game of post-apocalyptic Risk. He tries to drag some of the others into the fun, but I notice Morning leaning against the tunnel to Hive 3. She's changed into her tank top and sweats. Sunlight has brought back the rich color of her light brown skin. My eyes trace the bare shoulders, her dark collarbones. The look she's giving me is enough to spin my mind back to space, to her room, to our first collision. I think I'm going to sleep, I tell Jazzy. Catch you tomorrow. Jazzy doesn't seem to notice how quickly I stand. But as Morning and I lock eyes, everything else fades. I cross the room, and Morning slides ahead of me, moving into the underground. She looks back, and my heart just about slams through my ribcage. I catch her at the door to her room. She turns, pulling me down by the collar and into a kiss. It's the opening chord. There's nothing but the taste of her, the sound of us. A second kiss chases a third. Our hands play background music. She works my suit away from one shoulder. I reach around and lift her up. The rhythm of our song speeds up, the notes dancing faster. I let my lips graze her neck. Her fingers dig into my shoulder blades. We have to actually get in the room, she says. I kiss her neck again, as she reaches back for the handle and shoves her door open. She laughs when I trip my way inside, but silences my protest with the boom of kiss after kiss. I pin her on the bed, but she twists her legs around my waist, curling us, pinning me instead. Her dark hair falls over one shoulder, and she looks down at me like a queen. She takes me back before the Tower of Babel. Back to a time when there was only one word for beautiful. We walk through all the notes we like best. The weight of each touch and the tremble of each kiss shatter me into song. But Babel exists to ruin beautiful things. An alarm shakes through the silence of the room. It's still nighttime, Morning's on her feet first. It takes about 20 seconds for us to get dressed and spill out into the hallway. We move as a single unit. It would be easy to feel like there's some magical spell over us, some difference that marks us as a single unit to the other Genesis members. But it's more basic than that. It's instinct. We share a quiet determination to see all of this through to the end. There's an agreement now that we will survive this, and we'll survive it together. Overhead, we hear the unmistakable sound of gunfire. It's heavy artillery, and each shot shakes through the walls. Anton's pulling out knives, and I realize I left my claws back in my room. Morning's moving, though, so I'm moving. The rest of the Genesis crew pours out of the other two hives. We head toward the entrance, and the sound of gunfire booms louder. Outside, light floods in every direction. An emergency system is activated, and it's like spotlights roaming a prison yard. Kit stands about 30 meters away, his gloved hand raised, the digital interface flashing red and blue in the air. He presses a finger to one of the buttons, and another round of volleys fires from above. Each boom swallows the night. I squint past Kit and realize there are bodies on the ground. Even at a distance, we can tell they're Imago. Both forms lie motionless, staggered along the outskirts of the base. Morning tries to shout something, but the sound of the gunfire cuts her sentence in half. Kit looks almost possessed as he directs the base's defense systems to fire on the last standing Imago. The uninvited guest waits inside a Nixian cube that looks a lot like the one Morning summoned earlier. It's about the size of a shed. We watch as consecutive shots absorb into the material uselessly. The Imago fighter doesn't even flinch as shot after shot tests his defenses. He stands there, pacing inside the Nixian boundaries, waiting for Kit to come closer.
Stand aside.
It's such a forceful command that I duck to the right before I even get a look at who said it. Speaker comes striding through our ranks. Bally stands back, watchful. We've only really seen the smiling, quiet version of Speaker. The transformation is stunning. He lets a wicked mace drag through the air at his side. It's a threat, a promise. Kit's still jabbing at his digital display when he notices Speaker approaching. Words are exchanged, but it's too loud for us to hear them. We watch as Kit's face pales. He flips a switch to kill the gunfire. A false sense of quiet follows. My ears strain after smaller sounds, the soft crunch of grass and dirt under Speaker's feet. The distant buzz of the Nixian barrier. Seeing a new opponent approach, the Imago raises his weapon and points. Speaker doesn't slow his stride. He walks right up to the barrier and kneels. We watch as he plucks a few strands of grass, leans forward, and tosses them at the cube. I can just barely make them out as they cross the barrier and drop way faster than they should. Morning frowns over at me, and I almost miss Speaker's next movement. He rounds the barrier, backs up a few steps, and starts to run. At the last second, Nixia punches down from his left hand. He uses the spring to launch himself skyward. The surprised Imago flinches as Speaker dives through the top half of the barrier. My jaw drops about as fast as Speaker does. It's an impossible speed. He jabs the mace down, and there's a disgusting crunch. The entire barrier blinks out of existence.
"Holy crap," Katsu whispers.
Speaker looks down at the motionless Imago, then back at Kit.
"Are there any more?"
Kit toggles the interface.
"I only counted three bogeys coming across the barrier."
Speaker turns and kneels over the body. Most of our Genesis crew stand there, waiting for an explanation. Bally comes forward to calm us down, but I find myself drifting to Speaker's side. Morning follows. He's still kneeling there, breathing heavily. The bright spotlight makes one thing abundantly clear. All three of the unwelcome Imago are dead.
"Speak?"
I ask. We stop a few feet away. He looks back, and his face is gaunt, covered with flecks of blood. He shakes his head sadly.
It's a great shame to die this way, after all we've done to preserve our kind.
Morning offers a hand. Speaker allows himself to be helped up. Nearby, I can see gaping holes in the bodies of the other two Imago. Kit's activation of the base's defense system tore through them, probably caught them by surprise. Speaker reaches down and removes a Nixian weapon from his victim that looks alien to my eyes, but more than sharp enough to do the job.
They came here for you, he says.
His words set off alarm bells. You mean Isadora sent them?
Isadora? Speaker frowns. No, I apologize. Not you personally, Emmett. The entire group. They came here hoping to capture one of you.
Why? Morning asks. We were promised safety.
He nods. By the daughters, by our people, and by all of Sevenset.
Morning gets to the truth just before I do.
So they're a separate group.
After we signed the treaty with Babel, Speaker confirms, this cult formed. They did not agree with our plans, our dreams. It was not enough for them to welcome miracles into this world. They wanted more than they are due. We call them slings.
Slings? I ask.
Slingshots, he explains. Our civilization's primary function is permanence. The society is placed above the individual. We act in the interest of all, rather than ourselves. The slings choose to go against that.
We watch as he reaches down and rolls back the fallen Imago's sleeve. The tattoo along the bared wrist shows two moons in orbit. Speaker looks up at us.
They think it's their calling to go to your world. Slings are selfish. They actively ignore the treaty, all the progress between our species, to benefit only themselves. I believe their ultimate goal is to capture one of you and use you to launch themselves into the stars.
Morning nods.
They think if we came down from space, we know how to get back.
For a second, Speaker's face falters. There's the slightest hint of fear.
That is how they see you. But you are not tools. You are our welcome guests. We have rejected the sling since the very beginning, but it was unwise not to be more honest about the potential danger they pose. I don't think we expected them to act so early in your stay. Please accept my apologies. We will not make this mistake again.
Speaker,
Morning cuts in.
You protected us. That's all that matters.
And if your defense system had not sensed their approach, would I still be sleeping? Would three of you have been taken?
He sighs deeply.
Best to not think on such things.
Too fast to follow, he manipulates the Nixia. It's not a perfect match, but I can tell what he's formed is the same shape and idea as a shovel. I start to manipulate my own, but Speaker shakes his head.
We do not have many rules about death, he says, but there are some. When one man kills another, he will be the one to bury him.
Morning and I exchange a glance and decide not to push. Their world, their rules. His spade bites into the dirt. As kind and quiet as Speaker has been to us, he makes this look like familiar work. It's not hard to figure out that he's buried men before. Morning goes back to talk with the rest of the group. Most of them are moving back inside, thankful the threat is over. But I can't bring myself to leave Speaker. He agrees to let me help bury the other two bodies, acknowledging he wasn't actually the one who killed them. We dig a second grave, then a third. At the completion of each one, Speaker whispers a quiet prayer. Something about the bodies has me shedding my rust. Not that we had it easy here or anything, but the mindset Babel forced on us in training kicks back into gear. We are not safe in this world. 1,000 unknowns threaten to swallow me, to grind my bones into fine powder. When Speaker finishes, we sit there together, eyeing the unmarked graves.
"What did you say to them?" I ask.
I can still see the way they looked before he put them in the ground. The slack mouths and the open eyes. My mind echoes a vision of Kaya under her dark shroud. Speaker answers.
"It's a poem, written by a soldier who died in battle."
"Can you... I mean, it's okay if you can't, but can you share it?" He nods once. His voice deepens, almost on the edge of song.
"What weigh those things now that so bent you here? Much is made of men who rise like prayers from parted lips."
I make him repeat the poem twice. It's as perfect as it is sad. Speaker drifts back into silence. But the words remind me of a song that I love. I ask him to wait while I duck back inside Foundry. I dig through my knapsack and pull out my player. It takes a few minutes to hunt through artists, but I manage to find it. An old beat with stark lyrics. I offer Speaker the earbud, and he actually sniffs it. I hide a laugh, showing him how it works. His ears are a bit wider, and he has to hold the earbud in place. Together, we listen. The chorus comes slow, voices dropping down to the beat and lyrics center stage. Speaker nods along when we reach the bridge, as the words come quicker and the trumpet thunders in some studio background. When the song finishes, he asks me to play it again. I put it on repeat, and we listen until the sun rises, until we feel as far away from the dead as we ever will. Chapter 15. The Cosmonaut. Emmett Atwater. The days that follow are routine, but out here, that just means that no one dies, no one abandons us, and no one tries to kill us. We go about the business of completing the task Babel recruited us for, the one we thought would bring us infinite riches when we first signed on the dotted line. We dive down into black pits and fill Babel's already overflowing bank accounts. The wild part is that, compared to the rest of what's happened, digging feels like doing worksheets did back in school. It's the everyday, boring stuff. We're changing the global economics of our entire world. And it amounts to vocab practice, or textbook annotations. Again, I wonder how I can ever go back and reclaim any kind of normal on Earth. The routine goes like this. Arrive, unpack, flirt a little, feel guilty that I'm flirting with the fate of multiple worlds on the line, flirt some more, drill down into darkness, gut the planet, get that money, pack it in neat boxes, sleep with one eye open. Rinse and repeat. Only a handful of moments break through the standard routine. Beckway returns on the sixth day. He tells us that Isadora and Ida are safe. We've been rotating teams in their absence, taking larger crews to two separate sites, and getting more rest because of it. The setup was kind of nice, but the news from Beckway reminds us their absence isn't a good thing, at least not for me. They've been invited to the sanctum by the daughters. It's a great honor. He explains that the daughters are the ruling queens of Sevenset, one appointed as the representative of Glacius and the other on behalf of Magnus. I miss the mini lesson on the Imago government, though, as the news drives through me like an iron spike. Isadora has been accepted by the most powerful members of Imago society. The closer she is to them, the more power she has. My life might be in her hands already, and I just don't know it yet. One morning, our routine is thrown off when Parvin announces that Holly's gone missing. Speaker finds her a kilometer away from the base. She manipulated her Nixia into an axe and started felling trees. By the time we found her, she had enough firewood for a few days. Speaker reminds us that there is a treatment in the works, but the sight drives home just how lost Holly is to us right now. On the eighth day of mining, we finally reach capacity. It's the day Anton has been preparing for. Kit shows us the maps of the area. We've hit just about every mine within a 150-kilometer radius. Black dots spiral around a second Babel emblem well to the north. Kit highlights the marked tower.
Myriad Station.
He can't keep the sigh out of his voice. It's time to send you Corporal West's way. I'll just go ahead and warn you, he's not exactly Mr. Personality, but he's serious about the job, so at least you feel taken care of and all that. You'll have to travel by boat. The midsection of Grim Garden gets gutted by riverways and swamps. No real alternatives there. He swipes the screen and we all get a glimpse of the silo metrics. The entire payload has filled it to the brim, and the digital readout has all our extra Nixia labeled off to one side. "Here's what you've gathered," Kit explains. "Want to go up and take a look?" Everyone agrees to go. We're laughing and joking, moving out across the field, when Morning shoots Anton a look. He gives the barest nod, and I feel a chill run down my spine. He's been ready to go at a moment's notice for days. It feels impossible that he might actually launch back into space. This could change everything. As we walk, Alex slows, so he's stride for stride with Anton. He reaches out and takes Anton's hand in his. Just for a second, they look like two boys walking down the streets of Bogota, like a touch of hands has dragged them both through space, back to the place Alex calls home. It's a glimpse of some unwritten future with Alex, guiding Anton to the streets he knows best, and sharing a life free of Babel's shadow. In the here and now, all of that feels so far away. I watch, and the two of them say their silent goodbye with each step, each not knowing if the other will be safe where he's headed. One by one, we climb the ladder of the silo. Jazzy panics halfway up, and Azima has to shove her on from behind. A catwalk circles the silo, and a command from Kit has the roof retracting. We all stare down at the endless stacks of Nixia, just a bunch of poor kids who Babel thought they could manipulate. I try to remember that we did this. We earned this.
"So that's what $30 billion looks like?" Katsu asks.
"I could buy an entire country with that kind of money," Jamie says.
There's this undeniable moment where we're all kids again. Smiles trace their way through the group, and everyone imagines what it would be like to be that rich.
"I would buy a football team," Omar says. "Barcelona, maybe?"
"I was going to say the same thing," Noor exclaims, smiling wide. "Except Barcelona? Are you out of your mind? Come on, you Gunners. Give me Arsenal any day."
Longway smiles.
"I always thought my own company. Move to Shanghai."
Azima leans forward excitedly.
"I want to buy Victoria Falls. Once they are mine, I'll name them something else. A name that doesn't taste so much like milk."
"Can you buy waterfalls?" Jamie asks.
Azima looks confused.
"I thought we were playing a game."
"We were," Parvin says kindly. "I would buy a zoo. I've always wanted a zoo, and I know Holly can't answer for herself right now."
We all glance that way. Holly's climbed the tower with us, obedient as ever, but she's staring off into the distance, seemingly unaware. Parvin takes her friend's hand in hers.
"But she always talked about using her winnings to start a boxing school in Ireland. Girls only."
Parvin smiles.
"So for now, let's say she'd start hundreds of boxing schools. She'd make a whole generation of girls with a right hook just like hers."
Quiet nods of agreement make their way around the circle. Besides Parvin, Alex runs a hand through his blonde curls when he realizes it's his turn.
"I don't know," he says. "I'd let hungry kids eat whatever they want, I guess."
There's something about the way his jaw tightens, about the way he avoids eye contact after he says it, that crushes me. To his right, Jazzy's cheeks blossom a bright red.
"Well, I'm embarrassed. I was gonna buy an amusement park."
"It's cool," Alex says. "Just let the kids from my thing have free tickets, yeah?"
She nods her agreement. That leaves Katsu, Morning, and me. I can feel the others waiting for us to say something,
but I don't want to talk about what I want to buy.
It hurts too much to know it'll never happen. Babel promised they'd make me rich. but even that prize money is starting to feel like a pipe dream. I know Babel's given my parents a few payments, but what happens if the money stops? What happens if we fail? I had dreams of going back and being a millionaire, sure. I wanted to help the people in my neighborhood. I wanted to go back and carve something better out of what I left behind. Why dream of that, though, if I can't even make the little dreams come true? Morning's watching me like she knows exactly what I'm thinking. She looks down at the pile of money and shakes her head like it's just tainted treasure. We're both saved from the awkwardness of answering by Katsu, who laughs loud enough to shake the railings.
Three words, he says. Huge tower of jello.
Azima pats his shoulder gently.
That's four words, Katsu.
You're no longer invited. The rest of you can come.
The whole group laughs at that. I can't say how thankful I am for Katsu's jokes, for Morning's smile. Looking around the tower, I realize these faces are the only thing I'm still fighting for out here. There's moms and pops back home. Earth waits like some distant, guarded prize. But it's these faces that keep me breathing and fighting. It's these people who will stand shoulder to shoulder with me in whatever fight's waiting for us. The only outsider, Kit, leads us back down the silo. No one comments, but everyone notices that one member of the Genesis crew isn't with us. We might never know what Anton would have spent all that money on. If I had to guess, I imagine he'd use it on a few good knives. I imagine him, squirreled away somewhere inside the silo, waiting to launch back up into space right under Babel's nose. The rest of the group follows Morning's instructions. For the next hour, we create chaos. Games in the common space, exploring the other hives, asking Kit to walk us around the base. We force ourselves to move and move and move until the launch sequence activates. When it happens, we all stop and stare. Except for Alex. I see him walking back to his room, his face full of grief. No one asks if it worked. No one looks at Morning. We make sure that Anton's name stays out of our mouths. We watch as the massive pod streaks up through the atmosphere, and we offer up silent prayers that Anton can do the impossible. I can't help smiling. Babel has no idea what's coming for them.
Chapter 16. The Babel Files. Catherine Ford. My day begins at 4 in the morning and consists of 30-minute intervals. Review shipments, meet executives, phone China, approve flight patterns, email specifications to Roman, memorize speeches. And then there is the current square. Lunch. A hopeful label, but lunch is rarely ever lunch. There are no signs of seared tuna or gorgonzola salad on my desk. Lunch consists instead of the day's fourth coffee and a buffet of reports. What didn't deserve its own square has been relegated here. A pendulum counts off the seconds as I glance through the latest analysis of media intelligence. Approval rates are soaring. Defoe's plan effectively flipped the reporters who wrote the Babel Files. Their new documentary has been nominated for awards after making a splash on every major network. Interviews with the families of the winning contestants. How has the money already changed their lives? Each redemptive narrative strengthens our case. Our harshest critics are starting to sound desperate and unfeeling. When Jeremiah Atwater weeps in his interview, the nation cries with him. Poverty can be beaten. Cancer can be battled. Even the lowly can rise. To the press, we are darlings again. The bright promise of our past finally fulfilled. Thankfully, the truth of what we've done hides in wormholes only we can access. A second report details our own leaks regarding Nixia. BBC announces it as a solution to impending epidemics. Other reports explore its uses for combating consumerism or the failing field of housing development. It is the dawn of a new age, a post-scarcity future. I sign a pair of documents that will release another leaked video documenting Nixian gravity sealants. Scientists will marvel at the endless potential. Roman Beckett slips in halfway through my second signature.
"Ready for space?"
he asks.
"All packed up. And we won't have any surprises this time." "One mistake, and I'm the baby brother again," he laments. "No surprises. I spent all night looking through phone calls and surveillance. There's no one in on this one. Only the families know."
"Good," I say, handing him a folder. "The early reports look promising. We've been on planet for a week, and the estimated take is already 63 billion.
"Call me when it's over 100, Roman replies. "How's Plan A doing?"
"We have no idea. You know how our surveillance works there. We've got eyes on the bases we built and little else. The tech helps, but the atomites adapt quickly."
"It's the difference between billions and trillions."
"We haven't mined Nixia in 12 years. This mission is already a success." He pauses.
"Does it make sense for you to leave?"
I frown, scanning notes. "It doesn't make sense. But this is the plan we set out years ago. Babel's getting ready to reach down and pluck the forbidden fruit. It's always been agreed that I should run that part of the show from the tower." Still, leaving Roman to his own devices on Earth feels like such a glaring error. So much weight on such unsteady shoulders.
"You'll be fine. We've made the appropriate hires."
He wraps both knuckles on the doorframe.
"Well, bon voyage, then."
I make a few final notations for Rogers to look over when he arrives. One more review of our prototypes and the amount we're dedicating to different industries. Roman's right. We sit on the precipice between billions and trillions. More than that. World could become worlds. Succeed, and one day people will identify themselves by what planet they were born on, rather than which country. I press a button. "Lydia, my suitcases, please." The door opens and my secretary gestures. Two men remove the bags from a corner and vanish. Lydia hovers after they've gone.
"Good luck, Miss Port."
I smile.
"Take care of yourself, Lydia. Rogers is a benevolent sort of overlord."
The secretary nods and exits. I stand before the mirror and make minor adjustments. My business suit is dark, like smoke threaded into formal wear. A gift from Marcus. An appropriate sort of armor for what is to come. I take a back door out, down three flights of stairs, through two airlocks, and into the bright, futuristic room. 10 faces glance up as I cross to the front. Babel officials wait there, offering their regal and important nods.
I turn to address the children.
"You all know why you're here," I say, and my words weave out in 4 different languages, slithering through ears and worming down into hopeful hearts. "You were chosen to be at the forefront of the most serious space exploration known to mankind. The results of your mission will change the outlook for our species. The reward for your efforts will be beyond your imagination."
Part 2. The Genesis. Chapter 17. Grimgarden. Emmett Atwater. The next morning, we're all suited up, lined up, looking pristine. The group waits in front of a screen that's descended out of one of Foundry's interior walls. My stomach twists itself in knots as the feed statics to life. Kit presses a button and retreats to his place in the line. Babel. Our employers. Our enemies. A certain hatred snaps to life at the sight of David Raquin on the screen. He smiles like he didn't try to make us murderers. I glance over at Jamie. Kid looks ready to breathe fire.
"Good afternoon," Raquin says. "We've received your first shipment. The Nixian output has been beyond our early projections. Extra incentives are being sent out now. At present, each of your families has received $280,000. It seems your dedication is already paying off."
No one says anything. No one smiles. The money is why we came. But we have no idea if what he's saying is true or not. Every single one of us heard his voice on that recording. We know their true intentions. We know what's beneath the crisp suits and fake smiles. Morning replies diplomatically. Thank you, sir. Raquin swipes the air, and we can tell he's looking at his own map of Grimgarden. His eyes trace our progress, and all the black dots that remain unconquered.
You will continue to Myriad, Raquin says. Most of the remaining mines are concentrated in the northeastern regions of the continent. Our systems have highlighted the safest routes through the riverways, but I've no doubt you'll blaze your own trails north.
What about Holly? Morning asks. Are you aware of what happened to her? Raquin nods slowly.
It was in Kit's report to us. From what I understand, the plan is to treat her when you arrive in Sevenset?
It is, Morning says. But you could push that through. A word from you and the Atomites would escort her now.
She's not a danger to you, is she?
Morning shakes her head. I don't believe so.
And she's still working, Raquin points out.
It's exactly the kind of heartless line I expected from him.
Let's not break with protocol. She'll be treated soon enough.
I can see Morning trying to swallow her anger. She's quick to move on to the next subject before she says something she'll regret. And the Atomites. Raquin nods.
Everything has gone as expected. They have honored the interstellar contract. It outlines that you will spend 7 days at Myriad Station. You'll then move on to Ophelia Station for another 7 days. Your stay at Foundry was slightly longer than expected, but there are provisions that address that in the contract. Please be diplomatic. You are righting the mistakes of our early negotiations. When they ask you to Sevenset, you are to accept their invitation.
And after Sevenset? Morning asks calmly. How much longer will we be mining? Raquin offers a smile. It's meant to be reassuring, but he looks more dangerous instead. It's the kind of smile that's been dredged up from the darkest corners of the ocean.
The agreement all of you signed was for 1 year.
Was? Morning emphasizes the word. Has the agreement changed?
It's entirely possible you will return earlier, Raquin replies.
It takes effort to keep my hands calm and at my side. I fight the instinct to bunch them into fists. Raquin is lying. Every word he says drips with promises he never intends to deliver. Doesn't he get that we've scraped through the first layer of gold? All of us know that, underneath the surface, everything Babel's offering us is just rusted treasure.
Our people are working through the numbers, Raquin continues. In our business model, there's a sustainable intake that, if reached, would allow us to conduct operations the way we desire. If your groups can produce the right amount, going home early seems likely.
No one says a word. We've heard Babel talk like this before. I realize they can't actually expect us to believe any of it. They're smarter than that. All Raquin's doing is keeping up the cat-and-mouse game they started in space. Let things unfold. Show no tells. Always keep control. Is there anything else, sir? Morning asks.
Anton.
That one word cuts like a knife through our group. Raquin's eyes sweep through the ranks, tracing our faces for intentions and secrets. I look steel back at him.
Where did our Anton go?
We've worked to spread a few rumors. Kit's overheard a couple of them, and there's no telling what he took back to Babel. Morning shakes her head and puts on a play-acted frustration.
We had a difference of opinions.
Oh?
Raquin arches a silver eyebrow.
Did this happen during your private meeting?
Morning doesn't even flinch at that accusation.
It did. Like Isidore and Ida, we believe it was Anton's intent to move on to Seven Set and attempt to secure better partners.
Better than you? Raekwon asks. Or better than us?
Both.
Morning lets an embarrassed shade of red color her cheeks.
If he can't obey simple commands, follow my orders, he's not useful to me anyway.
Raekwon sifts through her words, searching for lies. After a pause, though, he nods.
Consider his recovery a secondary mission. Isidora's and Ida's decision has already complicated our plans enough. I'd rather we continue following protocol in our relationship with the Atomites. It's paramount that they allow mining operations to continue.
Raekwon glances through a stack of papers.
Let's get you all moving north. Godspeed.
The feed cuts. A crew lifts knapsacks and follows Kit out into an overcast morning. Speaker and the other escorts wait at the boundary of the base. I blink my scouter back to the map setting and find our new location pinged there. Kit stands there, looking like an awkward teenager who just got turned down for a prom date. He heaves the biggest sigh I've ever heard.
I'm totally going to miss you guys.
There's a second where no one really knows what to say. And then Kit turns to Longway and wraps him in a hug. Longway shoots us a what-the-hell look over Kit's shoulder before managing to hug him gently back. It takes a few minutes for Kit to work his way down the line, saying his goodbyes to all of us like this is the end of a damn summer camp. He even tries to give Holly a hug, though she ignores him completely. When he gets to me, he grins.
Let's watch a few Illuminats episodes when you get back.
I nod at him, feeling a little numb. How can Kit think there's a next time waiting around the corner for us? My anger at Babel flickers back to life. Did they lie to Kit the same way they lied to us? They're successfully making all the distant battlefields murkier. If our lives are on the line, we're going to fight. But it would be a lot easier if we had obvious enemies in the crosshairs. The Imago escorts lead us away from Foundry. We walk until we reach the crooking elbow of the adjacent river. On the map, I can see that this is actually a meeting point of five different rivers, which rope through the terrain like tentacles. Kit was right. For about 50 kilometers, there's not a single section of land that isn't diced into pieces by rivers and creeks and lakes. I'm surprised, though, when we spot a massive complex looming out through the trees. Speaker gestures that way.
We are passing the site that gave this continent its name. Grim Garden.
It almost looks like a mansion. Three connected towers angle skyward, windows broken, their lowest stories consumed by ivy and underbrush. Only a few strings of bright flowers offer their color to the dark face of the long-faded building. Speaker's quiet voice barely carries over the river's distant thunder.
Named for a general who made his home here. Back in a time when our people still warred with one another, thousands died on this plain. Thousands more died in defense of that river crossing. The general lived in Grim Garden and dedicated the last years of his life to burying the dead. We do not know his name.
Speaker smiles at the thought.
He did not believe he should be remembered. Too many men died at his command, so he had his name torn from every record. He succeeded in removing his name, but no one can remove the legacy of his honor. The entire continent was renamed in memoriam, Grim Garden.
We watch all three Imago stride toward the grounds, take a knee, offer a quiet word. We're all a little shocked when Holly follows them and takes a knee as well. I glance over at Morning, but she shrugs like, who the hell knows? There's something so sacred about it all that even Katsu doesn't make any jokes. Around the next bend, two pristine boats wait for us. They're almost flawless copies of the ships we practice with in the waterway. I turn to say something to Morning, and find Omar striding next to me instead. It's easy to forget how massive he is until he's right in your face.
Absent Anton, I am forced to step in as a chaperone.
Morning smacks his arm from the other side. Seriously, Omar? You realize Anton wasn't chaperoning